Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today in Washington, the battle over Title IX, the federal law banning gender discrimination in education programs, including college athletics, entered a hot new inning. A Bush-appointed commission reviewing Title IX has just released its final report to the U.S. Department of Education. Two of the women on the 15-member panel are criticizing those recommendations and today issued their own angry minority report. Title IX was passed in 1972 and has worked a revolution in women's sports. But the game is not over. Critics say Title IX is killing men's teams. There's no more wrestling at Marquette. Men's gymnastics was axed at Michigan State. And the University of Miami's men's swim team, with its long tradition of producing Olympic champs, including diver Greg Louganis, has also been sunk. The list goes on, so does the fight. In January 2002, a group of coaches took action and filed a lawsuit against the Department of Education, claiming gender discrimination against men. Defenders of Title IX smell a counter-revolution in the locker room. Do we need Title IX? Is it time to tweak it? Do America's young men and young women all get a fair shake in school sports today? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Julie Foudy, soccer sensation and gold medalist from the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta. She's one of the two members on the Federal Commission reviewing Title IX who today criticized the panel's findings and submitted a minority report. Good evening and welcome, Julie Foudy.
Good evening.
Hi, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Julie, tell us, what's the commission saying today, and why are you unhappy with it?
Well, there's a handful of recommendations that are being passed in the majority report, in the commission's report that's going to the secretary, that just went to the secretary today. Secretary of Education, correct. Mm-hmm. That Donna Deverano, who's my fellow commissioner, and I are concerned would substantially weaken Title IX in terms of loss of athletic opportunities for women. And there are a handful of proposals in there that would do that. And the second part being that being a report on Title IX and where we're at 30 years since its passage, we felt that there was a omission that, or rather a lack of acknowledgement that Title IX and discrimination for girls and women still exists today, and we were very concerned with that omission and wanted the Secretary of Education to understand our voice in this and felt that it wasn't represented well enough in the majority report.
Julie, we want to understand what's really going on here. I have it in my hand, a draft, or perhaps the report itself, I guess it's out now, mm-hmm. and it's got a lot of language at the top of this report that's laudatory toward what's happened with girls and women in athletics, talking about an 847% increase in girls' participation in high school athletics, for example, saying that it is clear, though, that more still needs to be done to ensure that girls and women are not discriminated against.
Right.
It's got the right tone to it. What are the details that you're snagging up on?
One of the issues that you're talking about the commission's report, not the minority
yes.
report, correct?
Yes, I am.
The commission's report, one of the details we talked about in our various meetings was that there is an acknowledgement, yes, that there have been great advances made since its passage 30 years ago. One of the things that we fail to recognize, however, is the current state of affairs. And right now we're talking about a difference of $133 million being spent more on men's athletic scholarships than women. Mm-hmm. You're talking about a 41% participation level at both the high school and collegiate level and a gap of 18% in participation numbers based on that percentage. And our greatest concern is you hear a lot of the time that this pendulum has shifted so far, and I heard you say it at the top of your show, this pendulum has shifted so far, and maybe it's gone overboard. And the point, when you look at the big picture and you pull yourself out from it all, is
yeah.
that there's still discrimination, and to not acknowledge the fact that, that still more work needs to be done with strong language, we felt was missing from this report.
Well, you're right that a lot of attention has gone to men's teams in different sports that have been disbanded around the country. That's been basically the headline that's come up out of Title IX world in recent years. Do you think that the Bush administration is looking to substantially or significantly change Title IX to reduce the protections given to women in athletics?
Well, I think that some of these recommendations that the commission approved and went on, that are going on to the secretary, one of the problems is we don't know the impact. We know that there will be loss. We don't know to what degree, and that concerns us. And to just tinker around the edges, as we've heard them say, is going down, as the old phrase says, this slippery slope. And we're worried that if you open these doors, it opens up Title IX to more changes. And when you look at the disparity that still exists, you know, no one wants to see men's sports lost. There's no question about that. How can we resolve this issue so that you're reaching equal opportunity for women and men, and you're creating a situation where we're not dropping men's teams? And that was something we never really addressed at the commission.
There's kind of an implication in this conversation, sometimes, Julie Foudy, that Title IX has ended up trying to pull off a degree of social engineering that just isn't natural to the society, that in requiring pure equality for men and women in sports, it's envisioning and asking for something that doesn't naturally occur. Is that nonsense in your mind? Is there something to that, or is it crazy?
Yeah, we've heard this argument a lot, that women aren't as interested in playing sports, and not to get lost in statistics, but when you look back in the 70s when Title IX was passed, 1 in 27 women played sports. Since its passage and opportunities have been opened to these women, 1 in 2.5 play sports. There's almost 3 million young girls out there playing at the grassroots level, and there's only 150,000 spots you could actually fill in college. And so the interest is there. Opportunities were never provided for them 30 years ago, 25 years ago, and that's changed. But I think the idea of, and one of the recommendations in the commission's report is that we go back to this idea of using an interest survey to say, hey, are you interested in playing sports? And every court has ruled that freezes discrimination into place. And so that's another recommendation we're very concerned with.
So are you concerned, Julie, that if we don't keep pushing or pulling women onto the playing field, they're going to get pushed off, that the tide will go back and men will once again dominate athletics? Is that a real concern or not?
I think that the major concern is that we can't lose sight of the fact that this is a civil rights law, and it's about equal opportunity. And if you have a situation, if you had a family, if you had two kids, one was a boy and one was a girl, you know, we would want the same opportunity afforded to the young girl as to the young boy, and I think every parent out there would agree with me with that. And to address the issue of these men's minor sports and some of their losses, I think, is an important one. We need to look at that. We need to say, well, how are the universities that actually are complying without cutting men's sports doing it? Because there's many that are. I think the current statistic is over 72% of universities are able to comply with Title IX without dropping men's sports. How are they doing it? We didn't hear from those people in the commission. I would love to hear some of their solutions. How can we create an environment in athletic? I mean, Title IX doesn't dictate to an athletic department, hey, these are the number of teams you have to keep. These are the type of teams you have to keep. It just says you need to show that you're not discriminating. But what athletic departments are going towards nowadays is smaller number of men's teams, larger programs.
Julie Foudy, give us just a taste of your personal life. Your soccer team won the gold at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta. You're a self-described Title IX baby. Olympic glory aside, what impact has Title IX had on your life as a girl and a woman athlete?
Yeah. I think everyone knows the physical side of it, the physical attributes, the wonderful things about playing and being a part of that, and the medals and the accolades. But to me, the most important thing that I attribute to Title IX is that I can walk into any room and feel confident. I can go into any situation and feel like I can handle it. And that's clearly, I can go into a group and feel like we can come out together working together because I've worked with a team. And I think those are attributes that men have always enjoyed. And I think it's important that we allow our young girls the opportunity to experience sports, and because they transcend in so many activities in life.
Julie Foudy, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
No problem. Thank you. Thanks.
Judy Foudy was on the U.S. women's soccer team that won the gold medal at the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta. We're joined now from New York by Jody Schneider. She's special projects editor at U.S. News and World Report. Last year, she edited the college sports issue and has written extensively about Title IX. Good evening and welcome, Jody Schneider.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Jody, we can smell that there's a battle underway here, but it's hard to make out exactly what the boundaries of it are. The brouhaha has been over men's teams being dropped from college rosters around the country. But what are the stakes here? What's really going on in this fresh round of debate over Title IX?
Well, it all revolves around something that sounds a little complex, and it is called proportionality. And basically, there are three prongs. There's a three-pronged test that the schools have to meet under Title IX.
To see whether they're treating men and women equally.
That's right. Whether they're giving, well, the test is whether are they giving women opportunities. Are
okay.
They giving women equal opportunities.
As opposed to necessarily strict equality. All right.
Right. And proportionality is the black and white part of the test. The other two prongs are less, are more subjective.
And proportionality means, do you have the same proportion of women athletes as you do women students in the school?
Exactly. So if you have 55% of your student population being women, which a lot of, universities do now. There's
because more women go to college than men.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And then 55% of your athletes have to be women. And
55% of your athletes, meaning
exactly.
only 45% would be men.
That's right.
Are schools meeting that?
Well, some schools are. But the way that they're doing it is, first of all, you can't cut your – you have to have your football team. That brings in the money. You have to have your men's basketball team. That brings in the money. Mm. And then when you start looking at these numbers, you do something called roster management often.
Roster management. What's that?
Yeah, again, another complicated term. But what you start seeing is that schools then say, oh, my God, we have to make sure that we have as many women – as there are women in or the percentage of women in the
make
student population is matched. So we need to have more women. We need to have rosters of women on, big rosters. So what they end up doing is adding things like crew. Some schools have added hockey, things where you have a lot of women on a team. But if that doesn't work and you got to match up your numbers, that's when they end up cutting the men's teams.
So they're cutting the men's teams not because of a lack of resources, but because it's the only way to pull the proportions into line with the student population.
It becomes a numbers game, essentially, in many cases. Now, some schools have found a way, have been creative and have found a way to add women's teams without cutting men's teams. But often they can't, in budget situations where you have tight budgets and you can't do everything, they have chosen to cut men's teams to be able to meet their numbers.
So where is this new commission pushing the focus then? Are they looking for a way to change the requirements of schools so that they that the guidelines are looser somehow?
Well, and yes, it comes down to proportionality. Now, everybody said we're not going to toss out the baby with the bathwater. We're not going to get rid of proportionality because that's what's allowed all these women to be able to participate. Mm-hmm. But what we are going to do is we are going to be less stringent in how we define proportionality and how we measure proportionality. And the recommendations that were made today, while being complicated, and some of your other guests may get into the ins and outs of them. Mm-hmm. Basically, what they say is that we're stepping back from strict proportionality, and we are going to try to do other things to measure women's interest in sports. The other two prongs are what they call of the test are one is matching the interests of women on campus,
right.
And that's where this interest test that Julie Foudy alluded to arrives, and the other is showing a good faith effort to continue adding programs. Athletic programs that serve the women on campus.
Jody Schneider, does all this amount to backpedaling on women's athletics?
Well, I think that depends where you come from, and we'll hear from your other guests. I'm a journalist, so I'm not an advocate of either position, but certainly conservatives say that when you have strict proportionality, you're striving for something that just is unrealistic. You have a quota system, and you are stretching to achieve numbers. Even if you don't have women who are that interested. On the other hand, then the women's rights advocates say, well, look, without this, we're not going to get there. People are not going to just because it's nice add women's teams. They're simply not going to do that, and that's the problem. If you don't have proportionality, if you are not requiring proportionality, if you don't hold schools' feet to the fire, are they going to do it?
And we've just got 30 seconds before the break, Jody. But if there's to be a change, how would it occur? This commission's report is being given to the Secretary of Education. Can they just hand down a change in Title IX?
They can, well, he can change, he can essentially change the interpretation of the rules and the enforcement. Yes, the enforcement mechanism is what's at stake here.
Wow. So we could have big changes coming down the pike. We're talking tonight about Title IX, about young men, young women, sports, and the revolt maybe against level playing field. You can join the conversation. Do we still need Title IX? Do young men and young women both all get a fair shake in sports today? And have women's gains come at the expense of men's sports? Is that okay? Is it the price of equality, or is it a travesty? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Title IX, about young men, young women, sports, and the revolt against a level playing field. You can join the conversation. If Title IX is pushed back, will women get pushed off the playing field? And a basic, old question, should men and women get equal resources for sports? Is there equal interest and equal need? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking tonight with Jody Schneider. She's Special Projects Editor at U.S. News and World Report and has been looking deeply into Title IX. We're joined right now from Jacksonville, Florida, by Nancy Hogshead Makar. She's an Olympic swimmer who took home 3 gold medals and a silver in the 1984 Games. She's now an assistant professor at the Florida Coastal School of Law and one of the country's foremost proponents of Title IX. Good evening and welcome, Nancy Hogshead Makar.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. And joining us tonight from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Mike Moyer. He's executive director of the National Wrestling Coaches Association and part of the organization that sued the Department of Education in January 2002 to see things changed. Good evening and welcome, Mike Moyer.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Nancy, let me turn first to you. You've got a glorious athletic career behind you and maybe still in your life. Title IX's been good to you. Tell us your story around Title IX.
Well, my story is... what part were you exactly?
Well, do you feel that your trip to the Olympics and your big bringing home of the gold there can be attributed in some way?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I actually hit the timing just right. When I in 1980 is when I went to college. It was my first year of college, and that was right about the time that women started getting offers to go to college, to get college scholarship offers.
Right.
Just 2 years before then, really none of my friends who also were world-ranked and whatnot were getting college scholarships. And so I came along at the right time at the right place, got a full ride to Duke University on athletic scholarship. And it was because of that scholarship that I stayed in sports so that I didn't peak at the age of 14 or 15, that I went on in the 1984 Olympics. I was 22 years old. I was still going all my best times and still improving physically and whatnot. And if sort of that scholarship hadn't been dangling in front of my nose, I doubt seriously that I would have stayed in swimming.
And the scholarship was there because of Title IX. We've got a lot to talk about tonight, but you know as well as I do that the thing that's been turning heads is this idea that men's sports are taking a hit because women's athletics has received more attention under Title IX.
Yeah, there's two problems that they have that the men have with that argument. One is that there's just no causation. You just can't say that it's because of Title IX that some men's sports have lost. I also teach not only sports law, but I also teach torts. And sometimes you've got two things that have happened at the same time. It doesn't mean one causes another. Like Benedictine was alleged to have caused birth defects, but in fact,
they're not necessarily related. And yet, you look at the list and you know the kind of lists that are put out, and it looks very impressive. I mean, baseball gone at Tennessee State, South Carolina, Colgate, University of Wyoming, University of Denver. You go right down through the sports, and you see that.
But you're not looking at a big picture view.
We want the big picture. We know you went on 60 Minutes, and they presented it as all the loss of men's sports, and you came away mad as a hornet. We want to get it just the way you see it here, Nancy.
Sure. Well, according to the General Accounting Office, which is the most authoritative study on this, in the year 2001, men's sports have gained both in participation numbers and numbers of teams. So men's sports, and not only have they gained in actual participation, but their budgets are increasing at a rate far in excess of women's budgets. We are heave-hoeing money into Division 1A sports in particular.
So why are all these teams, these sports being dropped off in gymnastics and swimming and you name it?
while some men's sports have experienced drops, wrestling in particular, I think, has lost, according to the GAO, 180 teams. Mm. Other men's sports like soccer and basketball and actually baseball have seen significant increases. You've seen 120 new soccer programs. At the same time, sometimes women's programs are cut, too. Men's gymnastics also joined on to the lawsuit. During the same time, women lost far more college gymnastics programs than men did. So, you know, sometimes sports are lost. Both men's and women's teams are lost at colleges. And it's not, you can't say that all those women's programs, the 100 women's gymnastics programs that were lost, were because of Title IX.
Mike Moyer, I want to bring you in here. How much of the loss of men's sports at the college level do you attribute to Title IX? And how much is just a natural ebb and flow of funds and interest?
Well, we don't suggest for a second that every men's program that was eliminated has been a direct result of Title IX, but we do know there's been over 800 men's teams that have been eliminated over the last two decades. And we have a laundry list of teams that we can directly pin to the unintended consequences of Title IX. And probably the poster program would be at Marquette University. They had an intercollegiate wrestling program that was entirely self-funded by private donations for a period of about 6 years. And in the spring of 2001, the university was still forced to discontinue the program because they could not meet the proportionality standard.
That means they didn't have the same proportion of women and men in sports as they had in the student body as a whole.
That's exactly right. We have plenty of other examples of where once it was announced that the program was going to be discontinued, the alumni stepped up and wanted to fund it, just like they had done at Marquette.
So even if the funding went away, the alumni would do it, but they couldn't because of Title IX's proportionality
rule.
Right.
Our lawsuit, and this is very important, our lawsuit is not about funding. It's about participation.
So Mike, are you suggesting then that this proportionality rule be dropped?
Absolutely. That's the sole focus of our lawsuit. Our lawsuit is not to debate whether men or women have more interest in athletics. We think absolutely that women were discriminated against in intercollegiate athletics 30 years ago. It was horrible. But a lot has changed over 30 years, as evidenced by today. There are over 600 more teams for women in the NCAA than there are for men. The focus of our lawsuit is this interpretation of Title IX. We support Title IX, too. We're a proponent of Title IX. What we're opposed to is the notion that undergraduate enrollment is an appropriate measuring stick of interest in athletics or any other academic program, for that matter.
Nancy, how do you read that? Can one support Title IX and be opposed to proportionality?
Can one support Title IX and be opposed to proportionality? No. I mean, Mr. Moyer cannot say that he's opposed to Title IX or he's opposed to equity in athletics because the vast majority of Americans are in favor of just such a thing. So he's not going to get any ground. So he sort of says, oh, I just want to sort of tinker at the edges. Well, the edges are the meat, what give girls those opportunities in sports. And I think every parent out there, I just want to say a couple things. One is, please, he talks about, he addressed the idea that that the boys' teams could raise private funds. That has nothing to do with Title IX. That has to do with basic civil rights laws that say that you cannot have a donor to be the front for discrimination. So, for example, you can't have a donor say, I want to give scholarships to just white people on the football team.
But I guess Mike was saying there, even if funds aren't available, there's money available, and the only reason the men's teams are going away is because of this law that says you just can't do it.
Yeah. What he's alluding to is the fact that, you know, women's teams are 10 or 15 years old, and there's no way that a women's team is going to be able to raise money the same way that a 100-year-old wrestling program or, you know, 150-year-old men's crew program or gymnastics or football program is going to. And so essentially, these are civil rights laws that, again, has nothing to do with proportionality or has nothing to do with Title IX. The school has an obligation to provide equal opportunities to its men and its women, blacks and whites, all religions, and that it does not, that it cannot hide behind a donor and say, it's not us, it's the donor. They can't use the donor as a reason why they're not giving equal opportunities.
Mike Moore.
Here's a perfect example of, in practicality, how this plays out.
Okay.
Let's say, hypothetically, a university has 50% of its undergraduate students are women.
Yes.
So let's say that 20 girls go out for the softball team and 40 boys go out for the baseball team.
Mm-hmm.
Under the current application of the interpretation, the baseball coach is forced to eliminate 20 boys from his roster. Back to the phenomenon called roster management.
Okay.
What would be wrong with telling the women's softball coach, you've got room to expand your roster by 20?
Nancy, how about it?
Yeah, because it's not unusual that men and women have very different interests on how they want to play their sports, and we need to make those allowances. For example, boys are interested in playing football, that girls are simply not. They're interested in playing other sports. Boys are interested in this principle called walk on in a non-scholarship but non-playing opportunity.
That means even if you weren't recruited or given a scholarship, you can show up and give it a try.
You're talking
exactly,
about Rudy.
Exactly. So therefore, yeah. Like there's the issue then becomes whether or not you're going to allow men's walk-ons who are budget decisions that cost the school money as the excuse not to open up a new women's team to which there is an incredible demand for.
But what about Mike Moyer's example here?
Girls want to participate and boys want to participate
right.
in very different ways, and the law does allow for that flexibility.
So if those 40 boys want to play baseball and there's only 20 girls who want to play soccer, you're saying then start another team with 20 more girls and something else.
Right, exactly. Have the girls have one softball team and a swimming team, and the boys have a baseball team.
Mike Moyer, what's wrong with that?
I'd say that would be absolutely fabulous if there's truly demonstrated interest and abilities of student on that campus that should have another team. But I don't think it's fair to just manufacture another team to artificially achieve this strict quota system.
Right, as Julie Foudy was saying earlier, right now there are 100, there's only 150,000 opportunities for women in college. Okay, there are almost 3 million girls playing high school sports.
So the funnel gets narrow.
Boys.
So to say that there is not enough interest or demand out there for girls playing sports is silly. I mean, of course there's interest and demand out there. When you've got, it'd be like the NFL saying, like, you know, we just can't find those football players to play in the NFL when there are so many boys playing college football out there for them to choose from.
Jody Schneider, you've been listening patiently. I want to bring you back in here. Are we hearing the kind of heart of the debate that's going on around the country?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that nobody kind of talks about in this sometimes until we start getting, you know, peeling away layers is money. I think that if there were, you know, just as much money, infinite pots of money out there, this would not be such a hard issue because you would just add women's teams. Sure, you would find scholarship money and you would add the women and you'd be able to keep the men and it would be fine. The problem becomes that there is not infinite pots of money.
Well, yeah, but as
Nancy Hogshead points out, the problem is that women can't raise money at the same rate. I mean, football and basketball pay for a lot of other things. They simply
true.
Do. And what is that? And then you add to this the whole other issue of this arms race at universities to build bigger stadiums, to feel like they have to compete with the Joneses.
How does that factor in?
And so basically you're spending so much of the money that you receive from TV rights and everything else to build stadiums and to pay for these other things that you turn around at the end of the day and you say, oh, my God, we really don't have enough money left over for these lesser sports. That is where you end up making men's wrestling and men's swimming and men's diving, the lesser men's sports, that sort of non-revenue-producing men's sports, compete against the women's sports, the non-revenue-producing women's sports.
Mm.
That's what ends up happening.
Yeah, Mike, Nancy, I want to ask you all to stand by for just a moment. I've got another guest I want to bring in for a couple of minutes here. Andrew Davis is joining us tonight from East Lansing, Michigan. He was a gymnast at Michigan State University. The program was dropped, as I understand it, because of Title IX. Andrew Davis, are you there?
I'm here.
Tell us what happened.
I was a gymnast coming into Michigan State. I was promised, you know, to be able to compete as a collegiate athlete. That was cut short, obviously.
Were you recruited? Were you a scholarship gymnast?
Yes, I was a scholarship gymnast from Washington State, so I'm quite a ways away from home.
So you came across the country to be a gymnast at Michigan State?
That's correct.
And the program went away?
It went away. We fought tooth and nail. The administration here wouldn't give us a bit. We offered so much, they wouldn't let us propose different floor plans for the gymnasium that we used to work out with.
And did it go away because of Title IX, Andrew?
Yes. That's the clearest excuse that we had, is that it was the numbers, but we went through quite a bit of trouble to get the Freedom of Information Act and actually compute the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And Michigan State would currently be in compliance with Title IX adding our team right now. They would have been in compliance with Title IX adding our team at the beginning of the year in 2002.
So what does that leave you thinking, Andrew, that they just didn't want to have men's gymnastics anymore, that it wasn't truly related to Title IX?
I don't know. I'm pushed in that direction sometimes because they never did give us a clear answer.
And as a college male athlete, what's your view of the impact of Title IX? You must see the joy that that women athletes take in their sports. Is it a good thing or not?
It's a good thing. It's done its job. I mean, nobody's trying to get rid of Title IX. Hypothetically speaking, if you threw Title IX out the window, not one opportunity for a female would be taken away because they would be there would be lawsuits like crazy, and no university would ever want to have that type of civil rights or lost that many lawsuits against them.
Well, maybe, and yet I guess Title IX would these days would be the basis for such suits. Andrew Davis, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I want to turn to our callers. There are many who want to join. Christy's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Christy. You're on the air.
Hi. I think that the minor men's programs are looking in the wrong direction for a scapegoat. I think that the real problems are with the massive football programs that suck up both the number of men so that they eat up the slots that are even available for
yes.
men. And quite frankly, only the top-tier programs produce enough money to support their the minor sports.
So you say it's big-time football and basketball throwing things out of whack,
yes.
not Title IX?
There is no equivalently large female sport. And as such, if half of your men's slots are taken up by football, at that point the schools make the decision to cut the minor sports.
Yep.
I spent my college career mm-hmm. swimming, which is typically a minor sport, and so I have great sympathy for all of these men's sports, but I think that they're looking in the wrong direction, just like your, I believe his name was Andrew from Michigan,
yes.
gymnast. He said that his school was technically in compliance with Title IX, but they chose to cut the sport anyway.
And maybe it's the big sports that made it happen. Christy, thanks for calling. Mike Moyer, how about it? Is it big-time football and basketball eating up resources and slots that's throwing things out of whack?
Well, there's a couple of very important things to know. Number one, the overwhelming majority of student-athletes in the country are non-scholarship student-athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of men's teams that have been eliminated have been at the Division II level and the Division III level, most of which don't even have scholarships, yet alone the bloated budgets that our opponents are talking about. Secondly, I could name Marquette University, Southern Colorado University, Seton Hall, Coppin State, Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. Those are just five schools off the top of my head that have discontinued their wrestling programs in the last 2 years that don't even have football.
Nancy Hogshead-Maycar, Mike's saying it's not because of the big sports.
Yeah.
How do they play in?
I'm not saying always. I'm not saying that football doesn't enter into it, but there's a laundry list.
Yep.
Of
programs that he mentioned, I mean, Marquette in particular has a very expensive basketball program. And Jody Snyder sort of talks, and on the one hand, she says, you know, the most programs make money. In fact, there are only, out of about 1,200 colleges out there, there are only 115 Division I-A. Of those, there are 41 that are making money. The rest of them are losing enormous sums of money.
That might be used to support men and women.
Men and women.
Nancy Hogshead-Maycar, we've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about Title IX, young men, young women, sports, and the revolt maybe against a level playing field. If Title IX is pushed back, will women get pushed off the playing field? You can join us tonight, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Title IX, about young men, young women, and sports. Do young men and young women get a fair shake in sports today, both genders? Without Title IX, could women's sports now stand on their own two sneakers? And 31 years after Title IX was enacted, do women athletes get real respect? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Hamlin's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Hamlin. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
The idea of strict proportionality seems to me a bit absurd. It's sort of like specifying how many times one should go to the bathroom on a specific day, based upon, you know, not regardless of how many, you know, how much they've had to drink.
I hadn't thought of that parallel, Hamlin, but you've given me something to ponder.
Yeah, so essentially, I believe a solution to it would be to survey the student body, incoming freshmen, as well as the other, you know, three levels, to determine what the actual level of interest and base the proportionality on that. In other words, I would have a flexible and dynamic proportionality that would essentially change every year, maybe in a minor way, maybe in a major way, depending upon, of course, the incoming freshman class would change the dynamic.
So don't force it. Don't be rigid. Nancy Hogshead Makar, how about it?
Yeah, well, the reason why courts have struck that exact idea down is because what they recognize is that an interest survey just is an instrument to let people know how limited girls' opportunities to athletics have already occurred. Let me give you a couple examples. The most powerful woman in sports right now today is Anita DeFrance. She's on the International Olympic Committee Executive Board.
Okay.
Never exposed to sport a crew until she went to college sophomore year. She was exposed to the sport, started playing it. Anyway, courts have routinely said that you cannot use interest surveys exactly in that
way. In other words, incoming women to college may not know how interested they might be if they had exposure or opportunity. Is that the argument?
No. It is that they've only been given limited opportunities at the high school level.
Right.
They've only been given 40. I mean, right now, sort of what's getting lost here. Girls only have 42% of the participation opportunities. Boys get 115% more of the recruiting dollars. So who shows up on your campus is not like, oh my gosh, how did Duke University get 7-foot guys walking around campus?
Not by accident.
I got recruited to go to Duke University. So boys are getting recruited much more, which determines who shows up on your campus. This happens at both Division II and Division III. And as our last scholar, as Andrew was saying, he got recruited to go there. So it's not – so, you know, if they only offer 30% of their opportunities for girls, sure enough, only 30% of the girls that show up on campus are going to be interested in playing.
But if proportionality is required, you're saying,
it's
then
not
sooner
–
or but,
it's not required. Okay, there are three ways of coming into compliance.
Okay, fair enough. But if it's encouraged by the fact that it's part of Title IX, then sooner or later, it's one of the three ways you can comply.
It is one of the three ways.
Yes,
but it is not even the majority of the way that schools that have been that the OCR has investigated have actually used. What they mostly use is prong three, which is they don't have any unmet demand by women to participate in sports. If you can show that you're satisfying the interests and abilities of the female athletes on campus, then you're in compliance. Prong two is how prong two is the one that says that, you know, we're not there yet, but we're getting there. If you can show that you have a history,
progress is going on,
right? That is how both Florida State and University of Florida are showing that they're in compliance. These tests, all three tests, are used widely by divisions 1, 2, and 3 in high schools. And to say that there's only one proportionality test is just plain old wrong and inaccurate.
We got it. Tony's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm glad to be on the air.
Good to have you.
I'm just extremely concerned about, as African American, I'm just extremely concerned about this country. And it just appears anything and everything that has given access and opportunities to minorities, and in this case, and or women, is just under attack nowadays. And it just bothers me because we all know that any organization, this country, whatever you want to call it, finds funds to do whatever it needs to have done. Mm-hmm. Whatever it values, it will find the funds to do it. And that just concerns me that we know the money exists. We know there can be parity with the sports without even having proportionality in place, and we know we always can change that.
But so, Tony, you're saying you see this as of part of a pattern or of a piece with the Bush administration going after affirmative action at University of Michigan. You see a kind of pattern here.
Oh, definitely a backlash against anything, whether it's for women or minorities. It just seems like anything that is not white male dominant is under attack now, and I'm just very concerned about that. I'm just wondering, we should really question that. I mean, obviously, Title IX was put in place for a reason. Affirmative action was put in place for a reason. And it just seems like all of that is just being forgotten, and we're just really going backwards here in this country. and something really needs to be considered when we're doing this.
Tony, we've got it, and thanks for calling in with a thought. Jody Schneider, how about it? In Washington, or in you're viewing it on from New York, are people seeing this debate about Title IX as of a piece, as part of a pattern of questioning civil rights measures?
Actually, I live in Washington, so I do see
okay.
it. I think so. I mean, I think the question on the table is obviously by appointing this commission, the Bush administration was saying, you know, we have concerns about this. Let's face it, they're not going to appoint a commission to look at changing it if they're not serious about changing it. And you know, we'll see what Secretary Page does with the recommendations, but I think we will see changes. And they are looking at all these kinds of things that look like they are so-called quotas, that where there's numerical requirements. And I guess the question that I think is interesting in all this is if you do not have the numerical requirements, people use those as a tool to get to what they think is fairness, to get to what they think is equity, where
yes.
be it, you know, enough minority students on campus or enough athletic opportunities for women. If you do not have that, what do you replace it with? And I think that's the big question. Some groups think that they're going to replace it with nothing, which would be horrible for Title IX, for women's opportunities on campus. But the question is, can you replace it with something else? It's complicated, but can you?
But the potential for a real rollback there. Nancy Hogshead, my car here.
I just want to make viewers aware that there's a big difference between a quota and a Title IX. A quota is when you say, okay, we're going to set aside 5% of this or 10% of these, you know, contracts.
We understand the distinction. You've made that loud and clear here, and we know there are three prongs.
No. What I was referring to was in the athletic context, rather than having a part of a whole, you have two holes, essentially. You've got both a men's program and a women's program. A school decides in the first instance when a high schooler is a freshman in high school how many opportunities they're going to provide when that person ultimately goes to college. They decide exactly how many opportunities they're going to be providing.
Well, we can hear that. We're out of time, I'm afraid, Nancy, but we can hear in that it's going to be parsed very, very closely. Nancy Hogshead Makar, thank you for joining us tonight.
Okay, if people want to, they can go into SaveTitleIX.com.
Okay, campaign on. We've got it. Nancy Hogshead Makar is an Olympic swimmer, took home 3 gold medals in 1984. She's now assistant professor at the Florida Coastal School of Law. And Mike Moyer, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Moyer is executive director of the National Wrestling Coaches Association. Jody Schneider in New York, thanks so much for being on.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Jody Schneider is Special Projects Editor at U.S. News and World Report. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the British Parliament takes on Iraq. This is On Point. Britain's House of Commons voted today to support Prime Minister Tony Blair's determination to disarm Iraq. The more than 3-1 margin of victory was surprising, considering the hits Blair has been taking in public opinion polls and from within his own Labour Party over his readiness for war. Still, the vote only came after a contentious debate among the MPs. Here are excerpts from today's debate in Parliament, beginning with Prime Minister Tony Blair.
I do not want war. I do not believe anyone in this House wants war. But disarmament peacefully can only happen with Saddam's active cooperation. 12 years of bitter experience teaches us that. And if he refuses to cooperate, as he is refusing now, and we fail to act, what then? Saddam in charge of Iraq, his weapons of mass destruction intact, the will of the international community set at nothing, the UN tricked again, Saddam hugely strengthened and emboldened. Does anyone truly believe that will mean peace? And when we turn to deal with the other threats that we know confront our world, where will our authority be then? And when we make a demand next time, where will our credibility be then? This is not a road to peace, but folly and weakness that will only mean when the conflict comes, it is more bloody, less certain, and greater in its devastation.
We're talking about going to war.
We're talking about thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of innocent lives being lost.
And the majority children.
We're talking about casualties almost inevitably among our own forces. We're talking about instability across the whole of the Middle East. We're talking about making the achievement of a solution to the Israel-Palestine question infinitely more difficult. And we're talking about the alienation of moderate Muslim opinion across the world. You don't undertake these things lightly. You have to have the clearest possible reasons for doing it. And I don't believe that those reasons are there.
The next time a large bomb goes off in a Western city, how far did this policy contribute to? The next time some Arab or Muslim state topples and is replaced by extremists, how far did this policy contribute to it? That's why this House should pause, and that's why I shall be supporting the Right Honourable Member for Islington North and Finsbury.
Yeah.
As I told the Security Council on the 5th of February, the United Nations pre-war predecessor, the League of Nations, had the same fine ideals as the United Nations. But the League failed because it could not create actions from its words. It could not back diplomacy with a credible threat and, where necessary, the use of force. So small evils went unchecked. Tyrants became emboldened. Then greater evils were unleashed. At each stage, Mr. Speaker, good men and women said, not now. Wait. The evil is not big enough to challenge. Then before their eyes, the evil became too big to challenge. And we'd slip slowly down the slope, never noticing how far we had gone until it was too late.
At present, there is an enormous lack of clarity. It's not clear whether it is for disarmament purposes only or for regime change. The Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary have both referred to regime change in previous contributions. Those mixed messages do not instill confidence in the international community and do not contribute to
will
the...
Will the Honourable Gentleman
no, I'm
allow
sorry,
the
I,
subject
no,
of mixed messages?
No, I will not.
Who is to help the victims of Saddam Hussein's regime unless we do it? I believe in regime change. I say that without any hesitation at all.
Yeah.
And I will support the government tonight because I think it's doing a brave thing.
Yeah.
Excerpts from today's debate over Iraq in Britain's House of Commons. On Point News analyst Jack Peaty joins me now. Jack, this is a style of debate you won't hear in the U.S. Congress, with the rumble and mumble and calling out and groaning. But out of all that, Tony Blair got his vote today, and no one was sure that he would.
That's right, he did. And, you know, you could hear behind that also the drumbeat of history. I mean, the 1930s, Munich, appeasing dictators. If you don't stop them here, they can go on. Of course, whether there really is any true comparison between a continental nation like Germany, which had been rearming for a decade, and a small nation in the middle of in the Middle East like Iraq, which has been losing its power over the decade, we'll leave that aside. But, you know, I've recently read in the British press a kind of background to what's going on with Blair that made sense to me.
And how do you read it?
And well, the people from the government have been saying, look, he's really trying to contain Bush. Over the summer, Cheney and Rumsfeld were saying, we don't need the UN. We don't have to go there. We're just going to do that. And Tony Blair realized that the international order was at stake.
But what's being contained now, Jack? The troops are massing.
Well, I understand, but he's containing Bush by going in with him. In other words, if Tony Blair weren't with him now, my God. This would be practically talk about unilateral. And the whole UN course has been the Blair course.
But is it a distinction without a difference? We don't know even now if the UN will sign on to this. The troops are massed, whether or not the UN's ready to sign on.
Well, I think they're going to get some kind of vote. But the whole point is the UN versus the not UN. And
mm-hmm.
He got us into the UN. And he did it to preserve international order. There can't be one if the United States, every time it wants, just does what it wants off its own bat. And that's what Cheney and Rumsfeld were saying. And this man has sort of said, no, we've got to contain America.
At a potential great cost, though, today, a 3-1 vote on the measure that would seem to clear the way for the UK to go ahead with Tony Blair having some kind of support in Parliament there.
Yes, and public opinion there, according to experts, is persuadable if they get a UN resolution.
Jax, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, this is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us.
This is WBUR. We're